I invite you again for some additional questions. Yes?
Thank you. My name is Therese Sandmark. I work as a consultant with research in responsible investments. And my question is regarding mining. So there's a new EU directive coming up that will require companies to report on conflict minerals if they source minerals for their operations coming from the DRC. They have to disclose where these where they source their minerals from. So I was wondering, as you are human rights experts, what is your take on this directive? Do you think it's a pragmatic approach to tackle human rights abuses?
We had an additional question there. I'll take a few and then we'll let the panel.
Okay, good. My name is Caroline Snellman. I work for attorney Hannes Snellman Attorneys. I'm a lawyer. And it's actually a good follow-up question to your perspective in terms of, is legislation a good way forward? As you might know, general responsibility is taken by no one. So responsibility usually has to be very specific. You know, someone is in charge of that everyone in a workplace should, you know, work sustainable, etc. Then that responsibility is not taken properly. So my one of the fundamental questions from a legal perspective is, who is supposed to be a company's conscious? I mean, the economist is going to calculate on a business. They learn in business school how to make good profits, etc. The attorneys, they make sure that they are in line with regulations. But as the economy is shifting from west to east, we are operating in a different legal landscape, which have different environmental laws, labor laws, etc. So you could be compliant, but still, from a Swedish perspective, sort of from a moral standpoint or human rights perspective, not be compliant. So my question is, where is the conscience of the business going to be placed, and who takes responsibility for that? And in the long run, are there going to be any sanctions? What's the, you know, remedy or sort of that way?
Rodri Williams, International Legal Assistance Consortium, based here in Stockholm. One of the sort of, I guess, possible implicit findings in this kind of a study is on overall policy coherence, I would imagine. I mean, you've looked at a very specific sector, and I wonder if you've been able to sort of make some observations regarding how the development assistance sector is doing compared to the rest of the sort of, let's say, just the Pillar One authorities in Sweden. On one hand, you think that development actors would be in a particularly apt situation to take on board human rights standards. On the other hand, it sounds like development assistance has been a sort of marginalized part of the overall discourse around the guiding principles. So should development actors have a particular role? Should they be particularly exemplary within the exemplary state system? And what are the actual sort of observations that you've been able to glean on that?
Okay, so let's start with that final question, because that was a big one. So policy coherence in the development sector. Who wants to take that one on?
I can start. Thanks, Roger, for that one. That's our key question, I guess. I mean, it's hard to answer in a one-liner, but an easier sort of spontaneous answer is that we did observe, I think, CEDA having much more in place than as the main development agency than SDU and Business Sweden having almost nothing. Well, they are not aid agencies, but they are increasingly coming into that field. And whether that's because of the reason that you sort of allude to other reasons, I'm not sure, but I think that's an interesting finding. And it does, of course, as we discussed with CEDA colleagues, I mean, it raises questions, but how can CEDA best support those new actors, other arms of the government when they come in? So maybe I'll just leave it there. I mean, if that's right, yeah.
I could answer the conflict mineral question.
we'll get back to that. If I understood your question right, I mean, there were a number of sort of sub-questions there, but how does the development sector, you know, perform as compared to other sectors, right, when it comes to policy clearance?
Yeah, I mean, the goal being overall policy coherence. So when developments in the guiding principles. Mm-hmm. What's the role of the development sector in that? Are they ahead? Should they be ahead? Do they set an example for the rest of the government?
Right.
Or is the rest of the government ahead because they've actually got more connections with private actors?
Right.
Right.
Sandra?
We had a lot of discussions and conversation about making the comparison only between state authorities and then also bringing in state companies. And obviously, if you see them all as actors of the state, kind of, and if we're not lawyers for a moment, if we see it, you know, the state has to push this out and take responsibility for not being associated with human rights harm. I think that any part of state, broadly understood, that engages with the private sector needs to have this as a baseline. If you're building the house, you want the foundations first. So I think the imperative to be at the forefront will be on any part of the government that engages with private sector, whether it be through procurement, whether it be through, you know, any other dealings. So I think that's probably what we would hope. And maybe, I don't know, Tia, if you have any, you know, particular from Swedwatch perspective. I know you've done work on other landsting and so forth and social procurement. But I think that from our perspective, at least our expectation was that given the strong focus on human rights by our aid policy and our development cooperation, we would really expect the development sector to be at the forefront because human rights is at the core of everything we do. So that's, I think, the additional argument for why CIDA and others should be at the forefront, maybe contrary to another one in you know, working solely with trade or something like that.
And the second question was, where is the conscience of the business? Anyone in the audience want to take that on, or the panel? Yeah.
No, I can just be, I mean, it's a very, very interesting question. And I think, as you very well pointed out, I mean, today, lawyers advising companies, I mean, you can advise on something being completely legal, but then that could have other consequences damaging the business in the long term or in the short term. I mean, it could be a media scandal, it could be investors who are disappointed with the company. So today, I think lawyers need to learn that you can't just stick to the law. You need to have some kind of moral compass when you work with companies and advise companies. And who in the end is supposed to be responsible? I mean, in my opinion, should be the board. And I think now that we have also the other EU directive on non-financial reporting, then we're moving towards that. And I think that's very, very positive.
Ellen?
Yeah, and I think it's precisely because we needed to move away from a very sort of legal perspective that we needed the UN guiding principles, because before the discourse was that, I'm sorry, but this is legal in the country where I'm operating. I don't know what you're talking about. Whereas the UN guiding principles have sort of overcome that discourse that it's not because, you know, the legal framework in that or that country allows you to be paying people below a minimum wage that it is okay from a corporate responsibility perspective. And I think it is also a little bit, I would say, often it's not actually true that if you look at labor laws in a number of countries in the developing world, they're not that bad. Mm-hmm. Then people don't comply with them. But, you know, it is possible to have a workers' elected committee in China. Businesses do not want to do it because for many reasons, but they wouldn't be doing something illegal. There's many examples like that where sort of the fact that the state is not being very strict in applying its own laws is being used by businesses. But in many instances, I would say there are laws that are not too bad in many countries.
Rasmus?
Yeah, no, I had just two reflections on your question about conscience. I mean, I don't think you can expect a company to have a conscience. I don't think that's the duty of a company, perhaps. I think the argument from our study is that you need to have a better alignment between the moral and the legal, and you need to have that legislation in place, sort of requirements in place. And just on the other hand, I also see, I think it's interesting for lawyers perhaps to be able to identify new opportunities to help state-owned companies and agencies do things that they don't have to do, but that's perfectly legal. And one example is linked to transparency. I had a very interesting conversation with one of the staff at the Compliance Advisory Ombudsman, I think. And they did a study on the international loan agreements and came to the conclusion that they don't see any obstacles for development agencies and multilateral financing institutions to remove the secrecy clauses or to dilute them. But there is a desire not to do that from the World Bank IFC. And I mean, there are opportunities to take this forward also legally, and I think that's quite interesting. Mm.
Right. I think it's a really good question. And when I work with companies, a lot of companies start off the conversation by, okay, so what's the business case for respecting human rights or not doing any harm? And I think that once you start, you know, investigating that question a little bit further, you can find a lot of cases of where human rights risk has transformed into legal risk. Companies are being sued, where human rights risk has transposed into financial risk because of various perspectives, whether it be torts, whether it be damages, whether it be shareholders or so forth. Legal as well as reputational, that's clear, I think. And the social license to operate is more and more being commonly used by companies. So I think the essence, which the guiding principles don't talk a lot about, but they should, or maybe guiding principles version 2 should, which is how do you make sure that all human rights risks are risks to a business? There might be 20% of business risks or human rights risks that are not business risks, but how do you make sure that those are at the risk? And I think that's one way to go.
I actually wanted to ask those of you working for the agencies in the study here about the transparency issue brought up in your analysis. You said that it was, you know, one of the challenges, one of the things that could be improved. You brought that up too, Elin. Did any one of you have comments to that, reflections, something about the challenge that you face? Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, we are trying to be as transparent as possible, but I think what was said in the report was very true, that we can be transparent about our own processes and policies and also grievances. But when it comes to our business agreements, even if we want to disclose information, we normally work with not only one partner, but it could be like 10 different investment development finance institutions or other companies. And to get an agreement from more than five to disclose information is a very difficult avenue, even if we have the ambition to do as most as possible. Then I can just mention on the grievance mechanism, since it came up then from Elin, how we are working with that. And we are trying to encourage all our business partners to have their own grievance mechanism in the project, but also on the business or on the company level, on Swedfund level, we are now developing an own system to take grievances on both our how we act, but also now how our business partners act. That will be in place with it soon.
Right. Any last questions from the audience? Matilda?
Yes, thank you. My name is Matilda Axelsson, work with the Swedish Institute. I was a little bit curious to hear more from the institutions that you actually examined, what they felt they needed to put those policies in place, or more perhaps those institutions that didn't rank very high, if they had any... if they needed anything or if they wanted anything, like the help, the support that you also said was something that was lacking in the beginning from the ministries and so on. It would be interesting to hear if they actually had any concrete... if they asked for help, more or less, to put these policies in place. Thank you.
Any other? You in the back are really silent. Everyone with questions decided to sit in the front. Ola?
One of the recommendations that came out, which I thought was really interesting, was the suggestion to develop routines for human right due diligence and in particular human rights risk assessment for non-financial services such as facilitation and matchmaking. And I think that's something that we need to consider, since we more and more work as we have less and less maybe just financial relations with our partners, and especially in a context where, you know, FDIs and other kind of financial flows are growing and the official development assistance is maybe decreasing in relation to that. So we need to position ourselves as a new kind of actor, and I guess this kind of question will be crucial then. And it's a challenge for us. I mean, we do work to kind of develop good communication with the companies, and you know, we come from quite different perspectives sometimes too. So how do we do that while at the same time being maybe more harsh than on the human rights requirements and what we require from them? So, you know, it would be really interesting to hear good international practice on how you can do that.
So first the help and support question.
The last question?
No. Let's start with Matilda's question. Okay. About, you know, to what extent did they actually ask for help and support?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, the institutions that ranked lower in the application and so on, they wanted any support from the institutions.
I mean, I think maybe those people should answer them for themselves. I mean, but my impression is that there was interest, and I think we'll have some follow-up conversations after this. I also think it differs a little bit between, I mean, where the institutions are at and the leadership perspectives, perhaps. So there are different challenges.
Perhaps the help and support question highlights, you know, on one hand side, we have the routines and the policies and the steering, and how important is that to actually transform institutions? And then on the other hand side, you know, most of us who work with people know that when things don't work, mostly it's because individuals who are inspired or not inspired, or who have knowledge or not knowledge. Mm. And one can, of course, have different opinions of what's most important to transform institutions. Do you have any reflections on that? Like, when you've seen things at work, is it because of steering and routines and documents, or why are some front runners and others not?
I mean, I would make a parallel to some of the businesses that we have been working with, and obviously it's a combination of both, because individuals at an operational level cannot change a whole company, but having only the CEO saying that human rights is important is not going to work. We have done a lot of capacity building or workshops with company staff, and it's quite amazing how people who have never heard about human rights can become champions of human rights, and how this can really change a company. And I think it's you really need to have a combination of both. And I mean, it is a bit frustrating to think that we cannot just solve everything with having procedures, because that would be easy for us. And we like, we are people writing documents, and we think that procedures can really help. But you have the human piece that you really need to get to people's thinking, especially in companies where, you know, they have no, I mean, people don't really think that they might have an impact on human rights. They don't know about human rights. And once they become sensitized to it, it can really make a big difference in the way in which they really act to prevent impacts from happening. So I think, yeah, it's probably a priority as well to go to the people directly.
Any additional comments? Rasmus?
Yeah, no, I can. I mean, coming from research, I mean, it's almost like this dilemma between agency and structure. You need to have space for civil servants and to act, but you also need to have a structure that enables that. And I think there are some tensions here that might have to be addressed. But I mean, probably, I mean, I guess Sandra and I, we can only do that much. We can write the report and do a study, and then ultimately, I guess it will be those of you sitting here, others who are not here today, who are championing these processes within your respective institutions. What you see that you need, and how you can take that discussion forward with respective ministries. The only thing I think I felt in the interviews or the consultations with many people were that, I mean, quite a few felt uncertain, I mean, and about being drawn into decisions where there's no guidance, and you sit and, I mean, say matchmaking, you will try making a match between a Swedish company and an African mining company or an Asian textile industry. and you might make a really bad decision. And it's nice to, I mean, I can imagine in that situation it would be nice to have that guidance if it's not there today. Mm.
Okay, the second, yeah, Sandra?
Yeah. I think one thing that's also that prompted me to think what you said, Rasmus. I think when it comes to human rights generally, and I've done work from other organizations too, it's almost like everyone thinks they can do it. And a lot of times people feel that human rights is something that's soft and fluffy and nice, and everyone can, you know, everyone has an opinion about freedom of expression in Southeast Asia or wherever it may be. So everyone can kind of take it on. It's not treated as a discipline, as a technical discipline like environment or like anything else. And so this is something that we really want to move away from. And that's why we keep saying moving from gut feeling to systems, because we need to make sure that we see the light. We see that, oh, although this is industry practice, it misses civil and political rights, for example. We need to have that scrutiny, because gut feelings and just common sense hasn't been enough in most companies, and it's not going to be enough in agencies unless we apply that extra perspective. So that's why we emphasize procedures. Although, as you point out, you know, people and procedures need to supplement each other, obviously.
Right. And some reflections on Ola's question about human rights due diligence, good international best practice, where to look for inspiration. Are you tempted, Elaine?
Yeah, no, I'm just trying to think of examples, but I can't come up with some. But I'm just thinking that it is a very interesting question. You're just opening a new field for us, looking at, you know, how you're being linked to abuses, not through any commercial relationship or any financial link, but through other types of services. And I think, you know, that's probably something that people have not really looked at yet, as far as I know. But it would certainly be very interesting. And also, you know, how can you use, what sort of leverage do you have when you don't have any sort of contract or commercial relationship or financial relationship, but other types of services that you deliver? I think it's probably a new field, and I'm not sure there's a lot of good practice yet in that area.
Okay. So my final question to the panel is this. Obviously, there is room for improvement. And if you had all the powers, what one or two activities measures or plans, what do you think is most important to move forward in this field? Who wants to start? Yeah.
I would say a baseline assessment. That is definitely needed to ensure that we are doing the right thing when we're moving forward. Because, I mean, this report, it focuses on a specific area and specific agencies. But it's clear that this needs to be done on a more larger scale and on a more general scale. I mean, looking at legislation in Sweden, on all of the principles, all of the agencies, in order to move forward in the right direction. I mean, that needs to be the first step, definitely.
And when you say baseline assessment, you mean a government level or on each and every... actor?
Each and every actor, yeah.
Right.
I would probably echo the importance of doing a national baseline assessment on all of the guiding principles. I think this study probably is a good basis on GP number 4, on the state business nexus. So, I mean, absolutely, but I also think that there needs to be from that national baseline assessment, a process to determine their priorities, but also to put in place a system for implementation of those measures. And I think the Swedish National Action Plan is a really good step, and you know, it is one of the best national action plans. There are not so many out there, so it's not too hard to be the best yet, but I think it really needs to be stronger in terms of there are measures that are announced, but what is the timeline? Who is responsible for that? What is the mechanism for making sure that there is a process after the National Action Plan has been published to really make sure that you move ahead in the implementation of the UN guiding principles? So that would be my recommendation.
I'll start and then maybe Sandra will fill in. It's hard to select from, I don't know, 20 pages of recommendations in our report, but just to flag two and focusing only on what we did in the study and our results. I think one is for the ministries to clarify the expectations. I it seems that only saying that that agencies or companies have to incorporate the guiding principles is not clear enough. I think there has to be a greater level of steering. And secondly, I think training and support to help people within the institutions understand what that means and how that should be done. I sense quite a lot of confusion among some of the institutions that didn't rank very high. I mean, and they need, I think, capacity and help. Yeah.
I think that every single agency and state-owned company should hire 10 angry human rights lawyers. To get the critical perspective. No, jokes aside, I think that there are many things, and I think that one of the things that would probably help is if there was a focal point, as Norway has actually done in their latest national action plan, at the government that ensures that there is one consistent approach to what business and human rights for the government means. And with all due respect, you know, the fact that the responsibility for coordination is at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs is great, but this is also an internal affair. So it needs to really focus on the first pillar. I think we will come far by looking at the first pillar and really not just thinking about the promotion of Swedish business, but really taking that baseline approach. And I think we can investigate as well as run at the same time. I think we know enough to act on some of the gaps too.
And if I could just make one last recommendation, is that there is in the Swedish National Action Plan a willingness to support other countries moving towards having such a national action plan. And I think this is also very important, that we need to have a critical mass of national action plans out there so that it works, because it doesn't work with having only 5 European countries having national action plans. We really need to move towards more countries having solid plans to address these issues. So I would say this is a point that needs to be followed up by the Swedish authorities as well.
Right. Thank you so much. Just to do a quick follow-up on the baseline study, who in the room feels more optimistic about being on the right track than when you came? Two in the back, and who feels less optimistic? So, thank you so much. Thank you to the panel. Thank you for all your contributions. If I just say one last thing, I'm not going to summarize everything. You want to go home and have dinner. But what strikes me as interesting in this discussion is the lack of conflict, actually. There seems to be a total, you know, agreement on the importance of the issues, the willingness to move forward. And that, I think, is quite interesting, and what I take with me from this discussion. Also, we want to see you in future EBA seminars, so you're very welcome to visit our website and to join us and follow us on Twitter if you want to have information about future seminars as well. Thank you.